it's Ouch Talk Show time. I'm Kate Monaghan, and sitting to my left, as ever, is the incomparable Simon Minty.
Yeah, I am, Simon. How are you, Kate?
Yeah, I'm all right.
How's motherhood?
Oh, you know, a bit tired. Like a little bit more sleep.
How's Scout's doing?
Scout's doing really well. She had her jabs on Friday, and that was hideous as a mother to see your little baby being injected. But, you know, it's important to do. And how's the hip?
Good. 9-10 weeks now.
Hip's just a bit older than Scout.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I feel it's a lot better. I can do quite a bit of movement without any sticks now. I can't walk that far, but the hip replacement is settling in. We are here, as we are every month, to talk about disability, and there's a lot of it about. For example, on the line from Coventry is blind university student, blogger and public speaker, Holly Scott Gardner. She has top tips for disabled freshers and will be doing the social media thing in about 20 minutes. Hi there, Holly. Give us one university starter sort of tip to whet our appetites.
I would say one of my main tips for disabled freshers is get involved with sports and societies.
Is that to go to the Paralympics?
Not for me, but maybe for somebody else.
Okay, so it's a good way to meet people.
Definitely.
Cool.
I would agree on the societies, not so much on the sports for me, sadly. But, you know, societies is all good. Also joining us here in the studio, we've got artist James Leadbitter, a.k.a. the Vacuum Cleaner. He joined us in 2014 when, having stayed in psychiatric wards, he hoped to design the utopian mental health hospital experience. The results are now on show at Bedlam, The Asylum and Beyond exhibition in London. What can visitors expect, James?
From our exhibition, they can expect a good understanding of all the different people we've spoken to in many different mental health hospitals to talk about their visions and their needs and what kind of care environments they would want to be in. And there's also a beautiful model that our designers have made of this perfect mental health hospital.
Cool.
Quite excited to hear more about that.
Yeah. On my left is the lovely Tilly Milburn. She's an artist, singer-songwriter and comedian and is on the autistic spectrum. She's co-produced comic books about Asperger's. She curated an entire floor of the Royal Festival Hall during the beautiful Octopus Club night and has recently been telling her story as part of the Wellcome Collection's Human Library. So what's a human library, Tilly?
It's particularly ideal, you know, there are a lot of people that struggle with reading for whatever reason.
And even if you like reading and you find reading easy, I think it's sometimes much nicer when, you know, the experience is interactive and you get to actually speak to people, converse with people, but the people happen to be the books.
So
a human
choose.
Library is full of human books.
Nice. You and I know each other. We went to a concert, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, also known as OMD.
You talked about that on the podcast a couple of months ago, didn't
you? I did, yeah. And so this, I've got my little note here that says you enjoy talking. So if you ever sort of overrun, we might sort of have to jump in and sort of interrupt you.
Yes,
if that's...
I'd rather. although I was reading an article about introverts, and you can actually, it would appear that you can be an introvert and yet actually talk rather a lot. Because when I read about it, I identified with a lot of that because I don't like parties, for instance, and that, you know, I tend to prefer, even at school, I always preferred talking in a smaller group or in a pair rather than sort of being, you know, surrounded by 100 people.
You're nodding, James.
I just can totally relate to that. Large groups of people can be a real challenge for me. Yeah, and like I went to a music festival for the first time in 6 years recently, and it was a real challenge, but actually having access to the accessible camping area and the viewing platform transformed that experience for me.
So, James, you got to go in the accessible area with a mental health problem.
Yep. It was at Shambhala, and I just emailed them and said, I have really bad anxiety attacks, I can't be in crowds. How can you help? And they said, well, just stay in the accessible camping area and use the viewing platform because it's not as intense as being in a crowd. And it meant I could go to the festival and see Sister Sledge.
Lost in Music.
Exactly.
I personally think that's a good thing. I think that's right. I don't think that you should have to have, you know, an obviously physical disability to mean that you can access something like that. There's many different reasons and ways why you might find particular situations challenging. You know, as someone that's on the autism spectrum, I can relate. I have no particular physical disability, but, you know, I definitely struggle with social interaction and anxiety.
Now, you work at Heart and Soul, a learning disability arts organisation where you make all your work, and they used to use a gong, didn't they, to stop you talking or to help you move on to the next subject?
They did that for one particular performance. This was quite a few years ago because I've been with them 6 years now, and that was when I was particularly, you know, I wasn't as confident as I am now. I wasn't as used to performing as what I am now. And it was, it added to the comedy, really. So
there is the gong show where comedians get up and as soon as the audience, like, they just whack the gong and you have to get off. I knew it's Kate is just waiting for this really quite rude...
Oh, I can't do it.
There you go. It's one of
Move
those
on,
bells
Simon.
You get at...
Move on.
You're one of those bells you get at this...
Move on.
Okay, this is really... this is a script. What are you doing to me? Hello, I'm Simon. Oh, get off. It's like one of those bells. You can probably tell from the sound. You get at hotels, posh hotels, and you're like, give me some service.
That's what you do all the time, isn't it? It's like a home for you, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's why I'm so confident.
But we're going to use this in the show if anyone, in fact, not just you, Tilly, if anyone's going on a bit too much.
Thanks, Kate. We're missing one thing, though. We have heard from one other guest, haven't we? Tilly, you have a toy pink pig there. I've met Del before. Please introduce, explain.
I am more than a toy. I don't like that I'm not just a puppy doll or a toy, because me and my Anna, we are friends. You know, I am much more than that, Simon, but I know that you realise that.
I do. I suppose it's for people who had never seen and they won't be able to see. So it is looks to me, but not to you.
We have to describe me. So basically, I do look like a soft toy, like a patchwork piggy. I'm not very big, but I'm not tiny. I'm like about a foot long, maybe slightly longer than that, and then almost a foot wide. I'm round. I'm rotund.
And what does Del do for you, Tilly?
I've had her 12 years, and basically it did start off as being... Well, she did start off being more like a source of comfort, and at times, basically, I was in a care home when I bought her, and I kind of used her maybe as a way of communicating at times with the carers, mm-hmm. and even my mum, because I haven't always gotten so well with my parents. I went through a time where I could barely converse properly with either of them, especially my mum. And whereas my dad still doesn't really want to talk to Del, whereas my mum's always said that Del's more reasonable
than you.
If she can't get anywhere with, yeah, she'll talk to Del. She'll ask.
So how old were you when you went into a care home?
I was a young person, but I was an adult. Basically, I wasn't diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome till I was nearly 20. So I just turned 20 when I went into a residential care home that specialised in autism.
And what made you choose
Del? And I was there nearly 5 years. I've grown up with soft toys, and I've had toys, like most of us, I've had toys that have come and gone, and toys that, you know, I just haven't been able to get rid of for whatever reason. Del is the first soft toy that I've really given a complete personality and voice and everything. And I never planned to sort of be a performer with a pig. I always wanted to be a performer, but I never planned that I would go in this sort of direction.
I'm just going to jump a minute, Tilly and Del. Kate, I saw James nodding as well. You bought a cuddly toy. Is that... No, what is... What's going on?
OK, well, this is Growly.
Describe Growly.
OK, so Growly is a very distinguished elderly bear who I've had for a very long time, and he's currently dressed in a Sully onesie.
And just to explain this, she's kind of really stroking it delicately, as though it's a real affection going on. It's like a little scout baby.
Yeah, it kind of makes up for when Scout's not here, but... Yeah, Growly's been in my life through thick and thin for a very long time, and I've never really thought about it until recently.
Yeah. Okay.
That actually, I think Growly's a bit of a support bear to me, because I can't go anywhere overnight without him.
Wow.
Yep. And when I'm having high levels of anxiety, I take him in my bag with me to work. Wow. And just knowing that he's there makes me feel better. And sometimes I'll talk to him. Obviously, I don't do it quite in the same way that Tilly, you do with Del, and you know, but I will talk to him, and he's the person who'll listen.
Does Growly talk to you telepathically rather than verbally, as in Tilly and Del?
Yeah, it's more telepathic.
James, where are you at on this?
I have a dog.
Okay.
Who I speak to, and the dog speaks back to me, absolutely.
A real dog? Or
yes, a real dog.
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah. And your dog speaks back?
Yeah.
Okay. Holly?
Well, I have a guide dog, but I talk to her quite frequently, but she kind of just takes a nap instead.
Simon? Do you?
No.
You're looking at us as if we're all a bit... You know, crazy.
No,
yeah.
And maybe in some cases you may well be. Oh. But no. I used to have Kangi, which was a cuddly toy which I had from birth from my grandma. And when I had kidney stones when I was 18, goodness, I grabbed Kangi as support. But Kangi's now in a drawer somewhere at the bottom. I haven't used it for a while.
Yeah, I think it's different when you just have a nice cuddly toy that
I couldn't say mine was a support. On it. Yours is kind of full on, Tilly, with Del. You have a proper relationship.
God, I know. I mean, it's sort of, yeah. I think if anybody was to maybe be classed as crazy, it would.
Hang on, you or Del?
We're both a little insane.
How do people react to Del when you start talking to them as Del, or when Del starts talking to them? How do they react?
Well, I'm a bit naughty because I complain about people staring at me, and like I get fed up with like people pointing. I don't know what it is, because supposedly I've got a hidden disability, but even when I haven't got Del with me or she's in the bag, nobody can tell. I still get pointed, sniggering, or people see it. It's not my imagination. My mum's seen people do it. When I'm out, friends have noticed people doing it. It's all the time. And you know what I think sometimes? I think, well, I'm going to give them something to look at. And I sort of play on it almost. I sort of play trick. I get Del out, or sometimes I don't even get Del out, and I suddenly do Del's voice on the phone to someone.
What's Del short for?
She is named after a carer that worked at the care home. She actually ended up being my key worker, which meant that we had more of a, you know, you tend to build up more of a rapport with the person that's classed as your key worker, although you will work with all the carers, and they came and gone, you know, most of the time they don't stay for very long. Unfortunately, she left after only about a year.
And what was her name?
Or so, but her name was Delphine. But Del for short, and that's...
And did you like her, and that's why you named...
Yeah, because I was a bit notorious at the care home. I was never physically violent towards anybody, but I seemed to be classed as difficult in terms of key workers. Key workers used to only be able to work with me for maybe up to 6 months before I then started to mentally, it was almost like I shut down with them. I just wouldn't respond with them anymore. They then worked out that perhaps it's that I didn't like it when anybody got too close. As soon as someone got too close, I would then rebel. I almost subconsciously, I didn't plan to upset them, but I would do everything in my power to sort of make them not want to work with me anymore. No. Whereas Del, I don't think it would have happened even if she'd have carried on for 5 years. She wasn't foreign, though, can I just say? She was very British.
Okay.
So I don't know.
So you didn't model the voice on her?
That's where it just came.
No.
What's your comic about? Because we've got some in front of us, Tilly, and I had a little read, and they're kind of quite political. They're pro or anti-government or policy and stuff.
I'm not trying to be anti-government. I just, if I could find something positive in the...
it's hard when the government are against you to not be against them.
It's really quite, you know...
Well, you're saying it informs your whatever you're thinking informs your art.
Let me just describe a bit of what the comics look like, because the one that I've got in front of me is all about autism perspectives. They're sort of pencil drawings with all coloured in, very colourful.
Yeah, very bright. Yeah.
And then lots of people with different speech bubbles around them, and they're all talking about their own perspective on your autism or autism in general. So you've got your dad and your stepmom, mm-hmm. your grandma, who is called Nanny Hippo, which I love. You've got your mum, and you've got some other important people in your life sort of around them with speech bubbles coming out, talking about how they feel about autism. So do you use this as a sort of a way of, I don't know, is it sort of a therapy, you know, talking to people and putting it down on paper how they feel about things?
With everything I do, maybe it starts off with me and getting my stuff across and how I feel and helping myself. But then I do actually want to enable other people to have that opportunity. I think we all want to hear a range of voices, and I've tried to showcase how my family feel about my diagnosis of Asperger's and the fact that it was a bit late, you know, and that they kind of felt cheated, really, that they weren't able to help me through my childhood as they would want. Like most parents, they want to do the best for their children, and they did try, but the circumstances, you know, in the 80s and 90s when I grew up, there just wasn't that support and that education in autism. I mean, it sounds ridiculous we're still talking about relatively recent. But it just wasn't there.
You can watch a Facebook Live that we did with Tilly Milburn on the BBC Ouch page, and there's going to be music from her at the end of the show.
And all your comics are up on the Heart and Soul website,
cool.
which if you want to have a look, I highly recommend you pop over to there, or we'll be putting a link up on our Ouch site, which is bbc.co.uk/ouch.
Nice.
Thanks. It's like I've done it before.
Yeah, www.
Yeah, all the W's, HTTP, :// Anyway, Holly, we're going to come to Holly now. Holly Scott-Gardner is a blind blogger and YouTuber who is becoming known in the disability community for her strong views and a willingness to share them on social media and beyond. She's also a disabled student counsellor at Coventry University. Now, we'll be getting Holly's social media update in a few minutes, but first of all, we asked her to come up with a few tips for disabled freshers starting university around now. We all know that starting university is incredibly stressful. It's one of the most stressful things I think I've ever done. Start university.
Did you take Growler?
Hell, Growly.
Growly.
Growler is something different. sorry.
Hold up.
Sorry, hi Holly.
Hello.
Oh, I've gone red again. Two months in a row. Whoa, hang on, it's not what I... No, it isn't. Is it?
Yes, it is.
I have Growler, it's an app on my computer as well that tells me when emails... Oh, look at you, now you're looking at me. So... Growly
definitely came with me to university. I could not have done it without. But
there weren't apps then, were there? Weren't smartphones?
No, exactly.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Yeah, in the dark ages. So, Holly, what are your top tips for disabled students going to university for the first time? That big, scary step.
As I said earlier, I would definitely recommend joining either sports or societies, because basically what happened to me last year was I came and I was there on Freshers Week and there were tables everywhere and I was like, I can't find this building. So I asked this girl for directions and she ended up recruiting me to the ice skating society. And
wow.
I'm dreadful at skating. I have really bad problems in my hips as well. So I mean, I really
can't. Hold on,
and
also
skate.
You are blind. So you were just skating around blind.
Yeah, I mean...
With
I would
bad
skate next to someone. Yeah, yeah. Well, that was the hips.
She's good,
a bit more
she?
Of a problem than the eyes. I could only skate really on one foot because of the hip. But you know, but yeah, I would just skate next. I'm terrible. Well, I used to ski, so I was like, oh, it'll be easy. But it's
got
nothing
you.
Like skiing at all. But through that, I met a ton of people and I went out lots. And for me, it made a massive difference to my first year at uni because I met people who I just wouldn't have met otherwise. So I would definitely recommend that. I mean, maybe do something you've never done before. You don't have to carry on. There's loads of taster sessions, so try out different things. Or you could join something that you really enjoy as well, that you know you're going to kind of find like-minded people.
Aren't there really fun societies nowadays, like...
There's Quidditch.
Quidditch.
I don't know if they'd let me play Quidditch.
Simon is looking like he's never heard this word before in his life. Do you know what Quidditch is, Simon?
Of course I know what Quidditch is.
I don't believe you. What is it, Simon?
It's like an app like Growler. No, it's Harry, but I know what it is, but I'm looking startled. So how do you play Quidditch?
Oh, okay. So basically, obviously you don't fly because we're stupid muggles.
Yeah,
I know. How disappointing. You do actually have a broom which you hold between your legs and you like run around with it. And the golden snitch is a person who has like the snitch hanging out of the back of their trousers. I know it sounds
James is roaring with laughter in the background.
And you basically, the golden snitch gets the free reign of the campus and they just run around the whole university campus. Yeah. And everyone else has to like chase them.
For a whole term or semester. I guess.
Until the game is finished. As soon as the snitch is caught, the game is over.
Anything else? Any other good clubs?
I mean, I'm sure there is, but Quidditch kind of takes, you know, it's the ultimate, isn't it?
So what are your other tips?
I would definitely recommend getting to know people who aren't just your lecturers, but for example, at my university we have a subject librarian, so each department within a faculty, for example English and Languages, which I'm under, we actually have a librarian assigned to us, and she's been very helpful for me. So if I want to know if books are available as ebooks, I can just drop her an email, and it means that I'm not always having to go through my lecturers, I'm going through someone who actually deals with that stuff.
Make friends in high places.
Yeah, but
that is a tip for life, not just for freshers.
It is. It's very, very useful, though. I would also say there will probably be issues that arise at some point, often through miscommunication. And the way I would handle that first is by talking to the person, you know, saying, I can't access this for whatever reason.
Okay, so accessibility issues.
Yeah. But I think trying to deal with it just by discussion first, because often if it's miscommunication, people are really willing to rectify it. I have had to fight for things. I mean, I turned up for an exam in January and I got given a printed hard copy exam paper. I'm blind, so that wasn't a lot of use.
What are you studying, Holly?
Spanish
Braille. So do you have, is it Braille?
I work exclusively electronically. I mostly use a screen reader. I have access to a Braille display, which I'll use for like presentations and things, but mostly I just use the computer, to be honest.
So Holly, we have a running thing. Can you say disabled Lou in Spanish yet?
No, I've never actually thought about it. Oh, good question. Maybe I'm going to Google it when I get home.
What didn't we try it?
Or ask a lecturer.
What would you guess? So what's toilet in Spanish?
Well, baño is bathroom, so I don't know if it would be that.
What's disabled?
Discapacidad.
So discapacitad baño.
It would probably be bathroom disabled, because normally the noun comes before... Yeah.
Baño discapacitad.
I mean, I'm sure they would like...
Any other tips before we move on?
Batch cooking.
I do cook when I remember. I'm terrible for not cooking. I actually like cooking. So what I do now is I actually bought a slow cooker and I cook in bulk and freeze it.
I love my slow cooker.
It means I actually eat real meals.
Yeah. I think that should be a staple, as well as that toasty maker that every student gets. You should also get a slow cooker.
Yeah, you're a girl after my own heart. I've got something like that, and I swear by it to everyone.
Yeah,
you know, because so you can make four or five portions at once and then freeze them.
James, slow cooker, talk to me.
Sorry, no.
Look at you, boys. No. You wouldn't know a slow cooker if it hit you in the face.
I've got two.
Everyday sexism, or no?
I do most of the cooking in my house, but I don't have a slow cooker.
You see, I think I have two, actually, a little baby one. And that's why I have a big one, but the baby one is the one I love, because you can just put it in. But I always feel it's sort of slightly cheating cooking. It's so easy. Unbelievable. That was Kate belling me, Tilly. So,
sorry, time to move on.
Okay. I just don't understand. How is it that it's cheating?
Because you know what? You only have to chop it up and then put it in and leave it.
Guys,
perfect. Did you not
hear my ding?
Yeah, we just... Stop being growly. Okay, you are here for a reason, Holly, besides all your top tips and slow cooking promotion.
It's time for the social media update. I feel like we should have a jingle for this. Ouch's social media. How's that?
It's beautiful.
Update! I missed the... Oh, go on then, Del, give us a jingle.
What do you want me to say?
Ouch. Wait,
are we on Facebook or something live?
Just the word.
No, just social media update.
Social media update for BBC Ouch!
Okay, that's going in every month.
There we go. Hashtag,
thank you, Tilly. Hashtag How I See It is the new campaign from US research charity Foundation Fighting Blindness. And it's caused a bit of a stir, so tell me more, Holly.
I'll give you a bit of background on FFB. They are an organisation that raises funds into the treatment of retinal diseases, for example, LCA and retinitis pigmentosa.
Oh, say that, what's LCA?
Leber's congenital amaurosis. So their aim is to raise money to find cures for blindness. And their latest campaign involves putting people who can see under blindfold and getting them to complete everyday tasks. So that could be watching their children for 2 minutes if they're a parent. It could be making a cup of tea. It could be going to the shops. And the problem with their campaign from the perspective of the blind community is that actually it enforces this idea that blindness is terrifying and it's this awful affliction that if you go blind, your life is horrendous. And then obviously when people feel like that, they are then compelled to donate to fix us because they mm-hmm. feel like our lives are terrible.
And when they meet you, they'll feel very sorry for you and certainly don't think you're capable of employment.
Yeah,
or
which
anything.
I mean, that's kind of a systemic issue already.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what do we call that? It's a sort of training method, and I'm trying to think of the name now.
I don't know.
Experiential, they used to call it.
Yeah.
And I remember it fell out of favour for maybe 20, 30 years, and I feel it is slipping back in. And I
are we going to get that BBC series back where they put celebrities in wheelchairs and make them go across London?
You know what? That was Channel 4. And it was Richard McKerrow, who also is part of Love Productions, who do Great British Bake Off. So he's got a lot to answer for right now, Richard.
First, we need the first disabled person on Bake Off, and maybe it going to Channel 4 will make that happen.
I quite like baking. Maybe I could do it.
What's your solution? I mean, do you have suggestions?
I don't think blindfold simulations are always bad. There was actually a study that was done in the United States that shows that if you put two groups under blindfold, for example, and one group learns the skills to complete the task, their view of blindness will come out being much more positive.
Yeah.
Whereas if the other group is just told complete it with no skills training, then their view will come out negative. Because, I mean, my parents, they know I can cook. But if I put my dad under blindfold and said cook dinner, he wouldn't be able to do it. But he's someone who's informed, so he knows I can cook. But if he was just a stranger, his perception would be, oh God, blind people can't cook.
Mm.
And that is, unfortunately, what society thinks.
So what's a better hashtag then? Not how I see it, but I'll teach you the skills, then I'll blindfold you, and then you can give it a go, and then you'll understand it better?
I mean, I think how I see it would be fine if it was done from the perspective of people who are living blind. So, for example, if the Foundation Fighting Blindness had reached out to people, because many blind people aren't opposed to a cure. I'm not personally opposed to it, as long as it's presented as a choice. I don't know that I'd personally take one, but I feel like we need to give disabled people choices.
To be fair, they have had blind people who have been involved in the campaign and who have been tweeting about it. They've had Christine Haar, who's the winner of MasterChef, and they've had David Paterson, who's something in politics in New York, I believe. So it can't be all blind people who think this is terrible.
No, I mean, I don't think any campaign ever is, you know. But I think if many, many people from a community are speaking out and saying, actually, this isn't beneficial, then an organisation which supposedly represents these people, especially people like me, who I am effectively their target audience. I'm a young person with a degenerative retinal eye disease. They are trying to cure me, essentially.
Mm. I'm just going to step in on this social media update because I've got one thing I want to chat about myself, which is the very exciting update that I did to my smartphone yesterday. And I was having a play around with it, this smartphone that is not an orange, but is the other type of fruit. I don't know how much we can say on the older BBC. I installed the latest update, and amazingly, there is the step counter that's been there for ages. But there is now a wheelchair mm-hmm. counter, so you can work out how much power you're using in your arms and how many calories you're burning by wheeling along now, which I think is amazing. It's kind of what we've been asking for a long time.
They're pretty good with accessibility. They've got a whole bundle of stuff going on under there, and you can get in there and have all sorts of stuff. I do remember reading about the wheelchair. It's part of the app, isn't it?
So it's the new update to the operating system.
I have a friend who's a very keen swimmer, because there's a whole swimming thing now.
There is.
On the watch as well, but she's got one arm, and she's now wanting to see if they've done... They did tests with loads of hundreds of other people. I wonder how far they can go. This could be so cool.
Yeah. I remember seeing a video of Aaron Wheels, who opened the Paralympics with his incredible flip wheelchair.
Yes, okay.
Flip. And he did a video showing that his step counter read... I think it read 30. And he was like, well, they've got this totally wrong because I've done no steps, but I have done, you know, incredible things.
Did we all see that? So he goes down the ramp and does... So am I the only one who, when he was in the air, thinking, wow, this landing, to get this right, is going to be quite complex, and then he just landed on a big, soft...
He can land.
I wanted to see him land, like Evel Knievel used to, and go whizzing off.
He can land very well. In fact, we've got a video up on the Ouch page of him doing some incredible things. Aaron is awesome. Mm. But yeah, I think he'll be very happy that he can now measure how much he's doing in his wheelchair. I mean, it was, again, it's not much use for me because my wheelchair is electric.
Scooter. I watched the, all to the bit I liked, I watched the actual update. They do that kind of big snazzy thing in San Francisco where they tell you, well, this is all the new phone and the operating system. And they talked about the wheelchair stuff. It wasn't, they talk about this as being a great feature. And I love that. They're just kind of out with it. This is part of the deal and this is always should be built in. I have the watch and every now and again it beeps me. It reminds me of some of your relaxation stuff, Tilly, and it beeps and says, breathe, so, which I'm doing anyway. But what it means is stop and just concentrate on your breathing. I was in a taxi the other day and I just stopped for a little bit and just, I can't ignore my phone, but this time I thought, and it's lovely. I think it's a bit mindful. You know, you just take a minute or two, just breathe, concentrate, look around you, and it's just lovely.
Holly, thank you so much for your social media update. I was just wondering, you make YouTube videos,
yes.
But how, as a blind person, do you make the videos look nice? How do you know they look nice? How do you do it?
I mean, I don't. My last video, my room was an absolute mess. And you see, my room's really messy in my video. It's really bad. No, basically what I do is I use my phone and it has a built-in screen reader, and on the camera app it will actually tell you where your face is in the photo. So I take a lot of selfies as well. Oh, that's really embarrassing, isn't it?
Who doesn't nowadays?
When you say it tells you where your face is, so you can move around and go left a bit, right a bit, what is it?
It will say one face near bottom left edge, for example.
Wow.
So then I can move the phone, it'll say one face centre, and it'll say if it's big face or small face. Obviously, you know how in focus it is.
That's so cool.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it's really handy. And then I basically use that, and I put my phone, when I'm filming, I put it in a tripod. So, you know, in a selfie stick, how it's got the little holder for the phones? It's kind of like that, but it's attached onto a tripod. So
I've got one of them.
I set that up on my desk, and then I can move it around to get the positioning right, and then I'll turn VoiceOver off on my phone so that obviously people can't hear it telling me all the time where my face is. So once I know my face is in the thing, I just turn the speech off while I'm filming.
Awesome. Well, if you want to see some of Holly's videos, pop along to bbc.co.uk/ouch and we'll have a link up on the website there for you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Holly.
No problem.
Now take a listen to this. I moved with my hamster and pig. That's Cosmopolitan Piggy by the one and only Tilly Milburn with heart and soul group Jazztronics. Hear the rest of it at the end of the show.
Now, artist James Leadbitter, also known as The Vacuum Cleaner, moved to London at 18 to find fame and fortune.
How's that gone for you, James?
Yeah, it's been fantastic.
You've made it to the BBC Ouch podcast.
Here we are.
He spent the next few years in and out of mental health hospitals and now wants to make the residential experience better for others. He came to see us in 2014 when he was just starting out with the Mad Love Project. His aim was to design the ultimate mental health hospital space. It's still a work in progress, but lots has happened, so let's pick up where we left off. Hi there, James.
Hey, yeah.
Now, James, when we last spoke, you were asking for feedback and you were about to start doing workshops. So what did you learn from that?
In the autumn of 2014, we did a lot of workshops and we found out some amazing things that a lot of people had a lot of really amazing insight into their own experiences and how to manage their experiences, that actually a lot of people wanted to be stimulated in hospital rather than have nothing to do. Kind of surprising that.
What kind of stimulation were they looking for?
Just things to do, whether that is engaging your body or engaging your mind in simple activities or having a routine or the senses being stimulated. So actually the sense of smell being quite important, the texture of things became quite important, and that people had very different responses to sound. So some people really needed a lot of sound, and some people, actually silence was a really healthy thing for them.
This got you to set up a mini designer asylum in Liverpool for 3 months.
Yeah.
What did it look like? What happened there?
So we had a space in the entrance to the gallery, and Hannah Hull, who I worked with on this project, we really worked with local people in Liverpool to really activate that space and make things happen in it. But we had a range of objects from, you know, working on different levels of privacy. So people spoke about the need to actually, privacy can be really healthy sometimes, even though you're distressed, or to have intimate spaces for conversations that you need to have in private, but also to have spaces to come together to do things together. So we spend a lot of time asking people, what do you do that supports your mental health, and how can you share that with other people? So really bringing people together to do things together.
So this was a public space. Did people come up and ask you about it and try to understand it?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of public engagement with it because it looked seductive, it looked very beautiful, it didn't look like a drab hospital, but also I think it was designed in a way to give privacy so people could do things in private, or if people were running a yoga class, or there was a like chocolate making workshop, that you could have a bit of privacy to be with the people as well.
You went and interviewed high secure patients.
Yeah.
What is a high secure patient?
That's a person that's in a high security mental health hospital, of which there are three in this country. Four.
What? Why are they in high secure?
So people are in high security mental health hospitals because they are a significant danger to themselves or the public. So some of the people in there will have been committed crimes and been found not guilty by reason of insanity. I don't like that term, but that's the term that they use. Other people have been in prisons and their mental health has become so difficult that they've needed to be in hospital. And then some people have committed no crimes, but they are such a danger to themselves that they require such high levels of support.
And how did talking to them differ to the other research you'd done?
The fascinating thing is in many respects, it didn't. Wherever we've spoken to people, whether that's in a high security hospital or at the South Bank Centre, everybody's talk about similar needs. But there was also a consideration of the safety and the safe environment that they needed to be in. So obviously in a high security hospital, there's a lot of health and safety, and a lot of the patients were quite aware of that and the need for them to manage their own conditions. So, but also there was a kind of reaction against that in terms of simple things like a lot of patients struggled with the sound of keys. There was constant sound of keys going on, and you know, I imagine for you, Tilly, like that can be quite a distressing thing. So, yeah, that it was a fascinating experience and utterly terrifying as well.
How is it for you exploring so much stuff around mental health, and does that affect your own mental health? I mean, do you have to have a release point, or how do you manage that?
I mean, again, some of it was quite distressing because people would disclose things to you that they have done or have happened to them, and that can be very distressing. And absolutely, a few times I cried myself to sleep. It was, you know, really, really tragic experiences that a lot of people have been through. But there was also quite profound hope in these places as well, that actually people are trying to move on in their lives, rebuild their lives, have this insight, and the solidarity that we had together by having positive conversations was really beneficial for my mental health, because I didn't feel alone. I didn't feel this, are there the people in the really hardcore place and they're not in the same world as me, and actually we have a lot in common.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever do anything that's not quite so intense? Have you done any more sort of more fun projects with your art?
I have, yeah. I mean, I'm doing a project in Switzerland at the moment, which is about hope and how we think about a hopeful future.
Oh, see, that sounds nice.
There we go.
What does a hopeful future look like?
A hopeful future is actually all the thing that we've been thinking about is actually how we care for each other, because there are significant challenges in the future. But actually, care not just being a medical issue, but care being a social issue, a political issue, and how we enable people to hear our differences and look after each other has really been where we've been exploring in that project.
I take on your point, Kate, because it can be intense. I also think, as a disabled person or as disabled people, our level of intensity, we can go a lot further. So if we talk about some of this stuff, to us this is just regular conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
But to someone who's two or three steps away, they're like, oh my God, this is so deep. I also think it's why people switch off around disability or mental health, because they're like, oh, it's just all...
Absolutely, but I also think the point of the Mad Love project, and the thing that we always make very clear with anybody that we're working with, is this is about finding positive solutions. This is about working together and listening to people's experience so that things can become positive and it doesn't have this fear associated with it. So how can we imagine something positive in the future?
So what does the utopian asylum look like?
Well, at the moment we have an exhibition at the Wellcome Collection in London, which is part of the bigger exhibition, Bedlam, the Asylum and Beyond. And actually, the Ben and James, the architects we work with, they've created a model of this space. And what we've realised is it's actually about a landscape that supports activities. So it's about creating, you know, different levels of privacy, but also places to do things, to sit on a mountain and look at the horizon, to have a swim, to have a space where you always know there's going to be another person if you are having a bit of a wobble and you want to talk to someone. Or there's a space that's really orientated around food, because food can be a real challenge for a lot of people. And it's also about the kind of tactile qualities of it, the fact that, you know, this model is made out of flock and it's kind of very, you know, you kind of want to cuddle it. And the colours are very bright and it's not this kind of deadened kind of beige institution.
I mean, what do you think the chances are that any of the things that have come out of your research might get transferred and translated into real life mental units?
Sure. I mean, I always say that what we're doing is a bit like high fashion, that you know, you see it on the catwalk and it will influence what you're wearing in subtle ways. But actually, we've now actually designed the interior of a children's mental health hospital in Edinburgh. So I've facilitated a process with the young people to get them to articulate their needs. And then our designers...
That's incredible.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
It's absolutely ridiculous that that's been allowed to happen.
Yeah.
But it has.
But I kind of feel also you're just a stage or two away from... You can go into people's houses and just make a very relaxing environment.
Yeah, and the thing is about... Obviously, it was working in a children's mental health hospital isn't emotionally challenging, but actually those young people had, you know, completely ridiculous ideas that we couldn't realise, but also really simple ideas. Like, they were saying, in our bedroom there's no chairs, and when my family come to visit, we all have to sit on the bed together. And it's like, okay, that's a really simple design solution. Mm.
So what else is being implemented?
The whole interior, the design is really focused on the fact that everybody spoke about the seaside, that actually it's a calming place, the sound of the waves, the horizon, the colour. So the whole interior of this children's unit kind of has a seaside feel to it and has lots of like little nooks and crannies so you can sit in the wall. And there's a kind of lighthouse that the young people can sit inside. It's a bit of a den. But again, it's just about it having a non-institutional feel. Though interestingly, the staff were also like, don't make it too homely, because we don't want people to stay for too long.
Yeah.
Well, it went through my mind when you were describing something. This is, and particularly the high secure ones, who may well be there for a long time. Yeah. And there's that bit of, am I temporary or long term? That's a difficult.
It's a design challenge, but... Yeah. You know, I think like any disabled person, I want the care and support that I have to be individualised to my needs. And that's a huge design challenge.
Absolutely.
I love all this. And I agree, I think whether it's long term or shorter term, it is not the amount of time, it is the quality that you get out of that time. You've got to make the most of that time. You know, because it is for you, it is for your future.
Mm.
And this is for future generations.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dale. There's been a bit of talk recently, James, about face-down restraint.
Yeah.
And this is still happening in mental health wards.
What's face-down restraint?
I was going to say, I know you've got some experience of it.
Face-down restraint is when you're restrained and your face is towards the floor and generally the two members of staff are behind you holding your arms.
So you're pushed down on your stomach?
Yeah.
What was it like for you?
It's horrible. It's just absolutely horrible. It's really... I mean, I have really bad anxiety attacks, and when I was restrained that way, that triggered an anxiety attack. But because the staff can't see my face, I can't communicate that to them. I can't say, you're inducing a panic attack and so, you know, you're being held face down and there's no way to communicate, and it's an utterly degrading experience.
I don't want to be clumsy. No, what is it that you've done that had made them think, we now need to restrain you? And also, what is a better way if there is really some necessity?
I was punching myself in the head.
Okay.
They had to act. And this restraint thing is a really difficult thing because, you know, In a utopia, that wouldn't happen, but we have to deal with reality, right? So I actually think it's about how we restrain people. And I think, firstly, letting the person know what you're doing, that, okay, I'm going to have to restrain you, and this is how I'm going to do it. And I've had a positive experience of restraint where it was a male nurse. He was like 6'4", really big guy. And he restrained me by sitting on the bed with me, and he put his hands on top of my arms and held my arms down, but spoke to me in a very gentle way while he was doing it, and said, said things like, I'm not ignoring how you feel. I'm not ignoring your desire to harm yourself, but I want to try and find a different way to get you through this experience. Okay. So actually, almost working out how we can get consent to do this, even if it's a real challenge.
But it's still happening.
It's still happening, of course it is. But the NHS should really be speaking to people that have experienced to say...
It's back to your...
Exactly. Talk to the people that have experienced it and ask them. We will come up with other solutions, absolutely.
When someone's in good health, when it goes wrong, what do we need to do?
Exactly.
And we all know then, and that makes life...
Exactly, and you have a care plan.
Right.
How do you want to be treated? Very simple.
So what's next for you, James?
We're doing a bit more training over the coming period, looking at how the NHS can work with artists, and the exhibition is continuing at the Wellcome Collection. And, I'm doing this new project in Switzerland.
So where can I come and see your art? Where do I need to go?
You need to go to the Wellcome Collection, which is on Euston Road in London, and it's on until the middle of January. I think there are audio described tours around it, and a lot of the objects that we built for our model, we have touch versions, so it's not perfectly accessible, but we have tried really hard to make it as accessible as possible.
Thank you, James.
Thank you, James.
No problem.
I'm going to
good luck
along.
With it. Yeah, see you there.
And you can actually also experience it online as well, actually. I should have mentioned this. There's an artist who's made a new Twitter bot called the Empathy Deck, and it reads your tweets and responds in an empathetic way.
Aww.
So that's worth following as well.
We've registered for that. We've had 2 tweets so far from that robot.
Oh, that's nice. Did you feel empathised with?
Kind of. They're slightly strange.
What were they?
Maybe it's because I kind of take things more literally. I think you're not supposed to take it too literal.
Are you still there, Holly?
I am, yes.
Are you going to tweet this? Are you on Twitter?
I have my phone in my hand right now.
Oh, you're doing it.
Empathy Deck.
Empathy Deck, yeah.
Just at Empathy Deck.
Yeah.
Tweet it a selfie.
No, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be empathetic about my face. I'm worried now.
Well, that's it from the Ouch Talk Show for October. We love your feedback and comments, so please do get in touch. We're on Twitter at BBC Ouch, and you can find us on Facebook or email us ouch@bbc.co.uk.
Thank you for joining us, James, Holly, Antilly, and Dell. Thank you also to the production team. That's Damon Rose, our studio manager, Nigel Appleton, and the producer was Emma Tracy.
And that was Dell wiggling her jingly bottom there. But playing us out...
Enough, Kate.
All right, I'm moving on. Playing us out this month is the one and only Tilly Milburn. Introduce the track for us, Tilly.
I'm excited about this.
This should be Cosmopolitan Piggy, and this was the first project that I was involved with, Heart and Soul. I actually wrote the lyrics to this song, and this was about 6 years ago, so it's a blast from the past.
Excellent. Well, cool. Thank you very much. We'll see you next month. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
There you go. It's one of
Move
those
on,
bells
Simon.
You get at...
Move on.
You're one of those bells you get at this...
Move on.